Good afternoon, and thank you all for standing by. All participants will be able to listen only until the question and answer session of today's conference call. Today's call is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And now I will turn the call over to your first speaker for today, Ms. Weiner. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. I'd like to welcome everyone to the National Kidney Foundation's People Like Us Coffee House Conversations telephone series. I am Sheila Weiner, Patient Services Director with the National Kidney Foundation. Today's call, Know Your Rights and Responsibilities, is the fourth and final call in the series of Coffee House Conversations calls about the new Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services conditions for coverage for end-stage renal disease facilities. On previous calls, we heard about the background and development of the new conditions for coverage, which took effect in all dialysis centers around the country on October 14th in 2008. And we learned about the state surveyors and what they do when they visit the dialysis centers. We also heard about safety in the dialysis center and at home, including problems of infection, cleanliness, and what's important to you to be comfortable on dialysis. On the last call, we heard about how to make sure you are getting the care you need. You can listen to these calls on our website at www.kidney.org/coffeehouse. While these calls are intended for patients and their loved ones, we also welcome the professionals who may be listening in. First, I'd like to welcome now Mary Beth Pentasulia. Mary Beth is a National Kidney Foundation volunteer and member of our Patient and Family Council Executive Committee. Mary Beth comes to us with multiple areas of expertise and is currently employed as a grants officer for the Corporation for National and Community Service, an organization that supports volunteers and communities across the United States. In addition, Mary Beth received her first successful transplant in 1997, received in-center hemodialysis from 2001 to 2004, and since 2005, Mary Beth has been on a six-day-a-week nocturnal treatment schedule. Before Mary Beth speaks, I want to remind you that we will be having a question and answer session after our four panelists conduct their presentations. So we'll look forward to hearing your questions at that time. And welcome, Mary Beth.
Hello, everyone. I have been on dialysis for a total of 12 years this time, and during that time I have, what I like to say, honed my ability to be an advocate for myself. The new conditions for coverage are extremely relevant and interesting to me because it solidifies a lot of choices that we need to make. Receiving information on the different choices and treatments is one of the mainstays of our health care. And I have found over the years that I've had to become a stronger and more forceful advocate for myself, at times looking for second opinions. I've recently read that less than 10% of all patients overall, and you know, multidisciplinary patients ever ask for a second opinion or receive a different treatment based upon asking questions. So it's extremely important that you do ask what your choices of treatment are, because you could possibly find a treatment that will help you to live a more fulfilling and fruitful life. One example that I can give you in choices, and the choices I've made, is currently I am attempting to receive a third transplant. I am highly sensitized because my second transplant never worked, and they had to remove the kidney. My dialysis center and the transplant center were able to tell me and give me information on plasmapheresis programs, the anti-sensitization programs that were close to my city that I could go and hopefully attempt to lower my antibodies and receive a successful transplant. Without that information, I would be, I don't want to say doomed, but I would have no other choice except to continue my home dialysis. And I'm extremely happy to have the option and the hope of receiving a third transplant. It's important to know your embrace and responsibilities. It's your health care, your life, and we owe it to ourselves to receive the best care and most current information about our health that we can receive. And it's hard because, yes, we are living within the health care system. So it really, the responsibility, the main responsibility for our health relies on us. I like to take charge, and you know, that's what I suggest to all of my fellow kidney patients. Sheila?
Yeah, thank you, Mary Beth. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences, especially regarding how you have become your own advocate. And these are certainly inspiring examples for others who are listening on the call and how they may go ahead and become their own best advocate. I'd like to now welcome and introduce our second panelist, Beth Witten. Beth has worked for 18 years as a clinical social worker in a hospital-based dialysis and transplant program and in freestanding dialysis clinics. And since 2005, Beth has been employed with the National Kidney Foundation. In 2006, Beth began working for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Survey and Certification Group. In that role, she works with a 7-member team on activities related to the new ESRD conditions for coverage. So we're pleased to have Beth here today to share what she knows about the conditions for coverage, and we welcome her.
Thank you, Sheila. I really appreciate being invited to participate in the teleconference. And even though I'm from the South, I have a tendency to kind of talk fast, so I'm going to try to tone that down. But if people have questions at the end, hopefully they'll be able to hear from me if I talk too fast through this. I hope the information that I share will help you understand your rights and responsibilities under the new conditions for coverage. After I talk about the actual sections of the regulation related to patients' rights, I'm going to talk briefly about the survey process for patients' rights, since some people may not have heard that call. The regulation lists 17 different rights for patients. Some are pretty much the same as in the previous regulation that was published in 1976. While others have been expanded to include things that weren't there before, and still others are totally new. Under the regulation, staff should treat you with respect and dignity. What's new in the regulation now is that staff should consider your personal and psychological needs and how well you're coping with kidney disease and treatment. For example, if you're depressed and you're angry about having kidney disease, the staff should refer you to the social worker to help you learn how to cope instead of arguing with you. Any information your clinic provides to you should take into consideration your primary language, your educational level, how you learn best, any learning barriers you may have. What's new in this regulation is that staff members are supposed to consider the learning barriers that you may have. So, for example, if English is not your primary language and you need an interpreter or a translator, your clinic should get one for you, especially to make sure you understand any legal documents like consents. If you're blind or you can't read, your clinic would need to find ways to educate you other than giving you print materials. if you're deaf or hard of hearing, your clinic should use materials that are written at your reading level to help educate you. Something new in the regulation is that staff should ask you if you feel comfortable talking about a sensitive topic in the treatment area before talking with you about that topic. That means that they need to have a private place where they can meet with you, and that would be any staff, including the social worker. If your hemodialysis access is in your chest or your groin area, the staff are supposed to use screens, curtains, or blankets to limit what others can see when they're making the connections that are needed for dialysis. However, staff must be able to see patients at all times, and even though the lighting may make sleeping difficult and sometimes vents blow air on people, it's important to keep your face, your hemodialysis access, and your lines uncovered at all times. That's the only way that staff can tell if you're conscious or if there's a blood leak. This regulation also requires dialysis clinics to follow federal and state laws that protect privacy of your health information. One law that was passed since the 1976 regulations is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. This particular law limits the sharing of information with others, but it does allow your team to talk among themselves and with other health care providers to make sure you get the care you need. Staff may not be used to patients asking to see their medical record, and they may be reluctant to share it with you because they may think you won't understand the medical jargon, or they may worry that you want your medical record to sue them. However, HIPAA gives you the right to read your medical record, to request corrections to it, and to get a copy of it for a small fee. The new regulation requires staff to encourage you to take part in your care. Staff should teach you to do as much of your care as you want to learn. They should also encourage you to take part in planning your care. In setting up care planning, you should be able to attend care planning meetings in person, by phone, or if it's okay with you, to have the entire team meet with you to plan your care while you're on dialysis in your dialysis facility. Asking you to sign your care plan form without offering you the option to be involved in planning your care is not meeting the intent of this right. At the same time, the regulation allows you to refuse to take part in your care, to refuse to plan your care, to refuse any recommended treatment, to refuse to take part in research, and you have the right to stop dialysis anytime. Speaking of stopping dialysis, in 1990, the Patient Self-Determination Act was passed. It required hospitals, nursing homes, home health agencies, and hospice agencies to tell their clients about their right to have an advance directive. Dialysis clinics were not required educators in this law. They were just kind of overlooked by mistake, actually. These new regulations now require your dialysis clinic staff to educate you about your right to have an advance directive. So they probably will be talking with you about that. And in case you don't know, an advance directive is a document that states in writing your wishes for what treatments you'd want to have or to refuse if you can't make your own state your own wishes. Some advance directives let you name someone you trust to make decisions for you if you can't direct your own care. For example, you may say in your advance directive that you wouldn't want to have CPR, which is chest compressions and breathing, for you under any conditions. If your clinic has a policy that anyone who needs CPR gets it, no matter what their advance directive says, the staff would need to tell you that. Knowing whether your clinic would honor your wishes lets you choose whether you want to stay at your clinic and have CPR if you need it, or to change to another clinic that will not do CPR if you don't want it. If you want to change clinics, the staff at your current clinic will need to help you find a clinic that will abide by your wishes for treatments you want to have and refuse. Now, the prior regulations only required dialysis clinics to tell patients what dialysis options they offered at that clinic. Some patients never learned about all options for home dialysis or transplant. What's new now is that your clinic must teach you about all possible treatment options for kidney failure, including transplantation and all types of home dialysis, not just the types that they offer. Your clinic must also share resources with you about area transplant clinics and what criteria they use to exclude people from their transplant list, and about where you can learn more about different home dialysis options offered, like Compare, which is on the Medicare website, and Home Dialysis Central. Your clinic must also tell you about scheduling options for in-center dialysis and home dialysis options that would help you work. Under the new regulation, your clinic staff must explain its patient care policies that could affect you. One policy that is specifically mentioned in this regulation is that your clinic may need to isolate you in a room or area, change your shift time, or transfer you to another clinic if you have an infectious disease like hepatitis B. Under the condition for infection control in the new regulation, your clinic must offer you the hepatitis B vaccine to protect you from this infection. The new regulation requires staff to tell you if your clinic reuses dialyzers. If they do, they should explain basic facts about reuse. Federal regulations don't require your clinic to have you sign a consent form for reuse. However, some state regulations require consent for reuse or allow you to choose not to have a reused dialyzer. If you don't want a reused dialyzer, staff should offer you options. One option may be to switch to a clinic that doesn't reuse dialyzers. Prior regulation said that your doctor should tell you your medical status unless it was not advisable to do so. The new regulations allow not only your physician, but an advanced practice nurse or a physician assistant to tell you your medical status. Although they're allowed to not tell you your condition if it's not advisable to do so, there should be few cases where you wouldn't be told your medical status. Now, these regulations require your dialysis clinic to tell you what your care costs and what, if any, treatments may not be covered by Medicare. If you have Medicare and your clinic would bill you for a service that Medicare may not cover, your clinic should have you sign a special form that's called an advance beneficiary notice. This form says that you agree to have that treatment and pay for it if Medicare denies coverage. One example of when this might happen is if your clinic provides 5 or 6 hemodialysis treatments a week, since Medicare only pays for 3. If your clinic plans to bill you for extra treatments that Medicare doesn't cover, the staff should ask you to sign an advance beneficiary notice. If they don't, they can't bill you for extra treatments Medicare doesn't cover. A new requirement states that when you and your team develop a plan of care, your clinic staff need to make sure you get what's listed on that plan, including helping you to get seen by outside experts when needed. Being part of care planning meetings allows you to help set the goals and to understand what your role is in reaching them. This also gives you a chance to point out anything you may have a hard time doing so the team can help you figure out ways to do what you need to do to be as healthy as possible. One example of something you might want to discuss is if you're not getting enough dialysis, how to get more without risking your job, which may include doing nocturnal dialysis in-center or at home or learning to do another home dialysis option. Another example may be how to get a prescribed drug if your insurance doesn't cover it and you can't afford it. Your clinic also should tell you its rules and expectations. Some clinics have rules about eating on dialysis or whether you can have visitors. Others don't. With rights come responsibilities. For example, clinics expect all patients and staff to treat each other as they'd like to be treated. Keep your clinic up to date on changes in your address, phone number, and insurance. Call if you'll be late or miss a treatment. Tell the staff if you think you'll have a problem following your treatment plan so staff can help you. If you disagree with a rule and your clinic won't or can't change it, you have the option to switch to a clinic that doesn't have that rule. Knowing and following rules will help you have a better overall dialysis experience. Now, along the way, some patients may have complaints about their care. Some are handled easily, others are not, and become grievances. If you have a complaint or grievance, you should know who to report that to. You should know what steps your clinic will take to handle your complaint, and your clinic should tell you when it was resolved. Timelines may vary depending on the complaint or grievance. Your clinic staff should also follow up with you concerning your complaint or grievance within that time frame. For example, you may have a complaint about how a staff member does your needle stick, and you complain that you've had several problems with your access when this staff member does your sticks. When you report this, your clinic may do more training with that staff member to improve his or her cannulation skills, or the staff may offer to teach you how to do your own needle sticks. Either of these may take time, but they'll help you feel less anxious at dialysis. Sometimes you may feel uncomfortable filing a complaint or grievance with your clinic. You have the option to file a grievance with your network and or state survey agency, and you don't have to file it with your clinic first. You'll hear more about filing a grievance with the network later. Patients sometimes worry that if they file a complaint or grievance, staff will pay them back. Some worry that staff will snub them or be mean to them, or hurt them on purpose, isolate them, delay their put-on time, or even discharge them if they file a grievance. This regulation prohibits your clinic from treating you differently if you file a grievance. You have the option to file a grievance through your clinic or with the ESRD network or the state survey agency anonymously. However, keep in mind that if you file a grievance anonymously, no one will be able to contact you for more information or to tell you how your grievance was resolved. Instead, you might want to consider filing a grievance confidentially so you can share more information during the investigation and you'll find out what the outcome was. The network or state survey agency cannot tell your clinic who filed the grievance. If your clinic figures out that you were the one who filed it, again, your clinic cannot treat you differently because you filed a grievance. Your network staff should, or your clinic staff, should let you know how to transfer your care if you want to change dialysis clinics, and staff should let you know what actions could cause you to be discharged against your will. You'll hear more later about what your clinic can and can't discharge you for. If your clinic wants to discharge you against your will, it must follow certain steps. You'll hear more about those steps later. In most cases, your clinic would have to give you and your network a 30-day written notice and help you find another dialysis clinic. The only time you could be discharged against your will without notice would be if you posed a severe immediate threat to the health and safety of others. Most conflicts that happen in clinics do not rise to this level, so that should happen rarely. You'll hear more about that later. These regulations have a new requirement for all clinics to post patients' rights and responsibilities in a common area where you and other patients and staff can easily see them. This notice must include contact numbers for the ESRD network and the state survey agency so you can contact them about a question or complaint. Even though these rights and responsibilities are posted, your clinic must still share with you the information about them in a way you can understand. Now I'd like to briefly explain the survey process for ESRD facilities. State survey agency sends trained surveyors to healthcare settings, including dialysis clinics. Federal law requires that nursing homes be surveyed every 12 to 15 months. Currently, no law requires dialysis clinics to be surveyed on a set timeline. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, asks states to survey dialysis clinics every 3 years. But some states have so many clinics to survey and too little funding, so some clinics go much longer between surveys. The only thing that could change this is congressional action and a law. When a surveyor is at a dialysis clinic, he or she observes care and listens to how patients and staff talk to each other. Surveyors interview staff and patients and read medical records to see if everything is charted as it should be. A surveyor may ask to interview you at the clinic. It's important to tell them honestly what you think and what you know. If you feel uncomfortable talking with the surveyor there, he or she will meet you somewhere else or call you at home, and often they give out their business card so you can call them. If a patient calls the state survey agency to complain about their clinic, or if a surveyor is at the dialysis clinic interviewing patients and patients describe violations of patients' rights, the surveyor can cite the facility. To let you know a little bit about what happens with the citation, when a surveyor plans to cite a facility for any violation, the surveyor discusses the findings with the clinic and writes a statement of deficiencies which must be mailed to the clinic within a set time frame after the survey. The clinic then has a deadline to respond with a plan of correction. The state survey agency must approve that plan. Depending on how many patients complain and how severe their complaints are, the surveyor could issue a high-level citation called a condition-level citation. This starts a several-step process to close the clinic. The clinic has a deadline to correct the problems before the surveyor does a revisit. If the clinic corrects the problems by that deadline, the termination process stops. If not, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, again CMS, can close the clinic. Violations of patient rights should never occur, but sometimes they do. A surveyor recently shared a horrifying example of a violation of patient rights with me. The clinic was treating a patient who had had a stroke and who moaned during dialysis. Staff imitated him in front of patients, and other patients imitated him too. On an interview, patients said they were treated okay, but some described how the stroke patient was treated. The surveyor cited the clinic for violating that patient's rights. Another surveyor described how patients interviewed at a clinic told her staff treated them okay. However, later several calls from home giving examples of disrespectful treatment. Surveyors do issue condition-level citations for patients' rights violations, and clinics have corrected problems to avoid closure. Now, this concludes my part of the teleconference, and I appreciate having the opportunity to share this information with you and look forward to answering any questions you may have later.
Beth, thanks so much. And please, I hope that the call participants are jotting down questions that you may have as we go along, and we would appreciate hearing from you as to any questions or comments you may have later on during the question and answer session. And Beth, thank you for explaining the rights and responsibilities in language we can understand. And also, we appreciate hearing about the grievance process from the perspective of what the state surveyors and state survey agencies are required to do. Now let's welcome our next speaker, Katrina Russell. Katrina began her nursing career way back in 1981 and has specialized in nephrology nursing since 1984. She has worked as a dialysis facility administrator and as a management consultant to several facilities and ESRD networks around the country. Presently, Katrina is the Chief Operating Officer and Lead Clinical Consultant with Dialysis Consulting Group. Welcome, Katrina.
Thank you, Sheila. I really appreciate the opportunity to participate with the National Kidney Foundation and our other speakers today. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Quality Assessment and Performance Improvement Program, patient satisfaction surveys, a little more about patient concerns and grievances, and then discuss involuntary discharge a little bit more than Beth did. The new Medicare conditions for coverage require that all facilities maintain an effective quality assessment and performance improvement program. This is in order to continually evaluate and enhance the care and services that are being provided to its patients. Now, this includes conducting patient satisfaction surveys. This should be a way for them to identify opportunities to improve care. Your facility may have its own patient satisfaction survey, or they may be using a tool that has been suggested by CMS that's called the In-Center Hemodialysis Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems. I think most people are referring to this as the CAPS survey. In either case, these surveys are typically anonymous, so participants can express their genuine feelings and concerns without fear that they are offending anyone or that they might incur any kind of negative responses from facility staff. These surveys can be very useful in many ways for facilities to hear from their patients about the areas where improvement is needed. In some cases, the results of patient satisfaction surveys may be used for a facility's planning purposes. For example, one clinic I worked with conducted a survey and found that there was general dissatisfaction with the televisions being provided for patient use during treatment. This facility took this into account during their budget process that year, and they purchased larger new flat-screen TVs. Now, another more important issue that was raised was concern about whether the patient care techs, the new ones that had been recently hired, were being trained adequately. This led this facility to do a thorough review and update of their patient care training program at that location. The most important thing I can tell you about patient satisfaction surveys is to participate. This is a chance to express your opinions and concerns and make sure that your clinic staff and management know what you think and what you want or need to make your dialysis experience a more positive one. If your facility does not conduct these anonymously, you should talk with the management of the facility about that perhaps being a problem. If these satisfaction surveys are not anonymous, I would guess that the facility may not be getting many of them completed and returned. Every patient should be able to express their concerns about the care they are receiving without having to worry about whether it will impact how they are treated at the facility. I know it can be very scary to complain or say anything negative to the staff who are responsible for providing the dialysis care that you need. But for your sake and the sake of other patients, if you see a problem, you definitely need to discuss it with someone in authority at the clinic. Now, I know that our next speaker is going to be addressing grievances in more detail, but I'd like to touch on a couple of issues related to this topic. One is that facilities must monitor and track patient complaints and grievances as part of their QAPI, and that's Quality Assessment and Performance Improvement Program. The clinic should be using information from these grievances or concerns to better understand their patient's perception of the care they are receiving and how the facility might be able to improve that care. The patient's perception is such a key issue. I've seen many times when a patient had a concern and it turned out that the problem was actually a lack of information or understanding about their particular facility's policies and procedures. An example might be that a new patient is upset because they don't get on the machine and have their treatment start at exactly the same time each scheduled treatment day. They were told to show up for treatments at 10 o'clock. They show up at that time, but some days their treatment may start at 9:45, other days 10 o'clock, or sometimes 10:15. Now, having a clinic employee explain that the scheduled time includes a 30-minute window, meaning that the treatment may start 15 minutes before or after their scheduled time, and explaining the reason, and that would be because another patient may be on the machine before them, and sometimes there could be a complication that delay the ability of the staff to safely complete and discharge that patient, then disinfect and set up the machine for them. This explanation will often help that new patient better understand how the clinic operates. If a patient brings up a concern like this, it can also provide an opportunity for better communication going both ways. For example, this could be a good time for this new patient to explain about any personal responsibilities that require them to be on a tight schedule. Maybe they're working or they're attending classes, and the facility needs to know that so that they could consider a schedule change. And that really just leads me to the most important thing about grievances, and that's communication. Be sure that you do let your clinic know about any concerns you have. That may be the only way the clinic will have an opportunity to learn about your particular concern so they can deal with it. I've been a dialysis nurse administrator for more than 20 years now, and I've worked with many, many different dialysis clinics. I can say that based on my experience, most dialysis companies and dialysis staff really want to do the right thing, and they want to provide high-quality, safe care to their patients. But the employees can often get caught up in the day-to-day pressures of making sure that they're following all the regulations and they're following the budgets that require them to be efficient. Sometimes they get so caught up in those concerns, they can forget about the patient's perspective. You as dialysis patients should never feel bad reminding them that you want to be treated as an important part of the process. In fact, you are the most important part, and these new Medicare regulations are helping to remind the facilities of this. By expressing your concerns via complaints or grievances, you're giving the clinic information that they can monitor and track to identify systems or areas of their operations that they need to work on to improve. So what should you expect when you do have a concern you need to express? Every dialysis clinic is required to explain to each patient what its process is for dealing with complaints or grievances. The clinic's grievance process should be explained within the first 6 treatments received at the facility. While there may be some differences in the specific policy from facility to facility, the elements of each patient's complaint or grievance process should include several basic components such as they should reassure you that it is okay to tell someone when there is a problem and that it's safe to do so without worrying that you will be treated differently after you make the complaint. You should be told how to inform the clinic of a problem. It could be verbal, it could be written, or maybe it'll be both, since sometimes the clinic may ask you to write out what starts as a verbal expression of a concern. They should tell you who should be informed. It may start with your charge nurse, social worker, or director of nursing, depending on what the issue is. They should tell you what they are going to do. The clinic should investigate the problem to find causes and resolutions. They should tell you how they will keep you informed of the process. there should be specific time periods for reporting back to you what was discovered about your concern and what was or what will be done. There should also be an opportunity to take your concern to a higher level if you are not satisfied that the problem has been handled adequately. Depending on the facility ownership or structure, this could include the involvement of, say, the administrator, the medical director, a regional director, or the governing body. And every facility's process should include how to contact the End-Stage Renal Disease Network or state survey agency in their location. As I said before, the most important thing is to communicate with your clinic when you do have a concern or problem. You may want to ask for a private meeting if you're not comfortable talking about your concern out in the treatment area. It can be helpful for the clinic if you can be patient and give them time to look into the problem, research the causes, and get back to you. And they should indeed be getting back to you in a reasonable period of time. Now let me shift gears and take a few minutes to discuss another issue that can be a real challenge both for the dialysis facility and patients. And I'm talking about involuntary discharge of a patient from a facility. As Beth mentioned, involuntary discharge is when a clinic decides they can no longer provide care to a patient, but the patient really doesn't want to leave. Fortunately, this does not happen often, but the new conditions for coverage have specific language that addresses this issue and the appropriate process to be followed. As Beth indicated in her review of patient rights, every patient must be informed of their facility's admission and discharge policies. This must include their policy regarding involuntary discharge. Often this information will be provided to new patients as part of an admission packet of materials. And by the way, I'd like to take a minute to comment on what new patients may be dealing with. When you start on dialysis, you get an awful lot of materials and information in that first few treatments, and many patients may not be feeling their best at this time. Really important for new patients to review all the materials they may get in the first couple of weeks, review them once again after they've been on dialysis for a while and should be feeling better. This may be a few weeks or it may be a month or two after actually starting dialysis. But this would help to make sure that dialysis patients understand the information being presented. Now back to involuntary discharge. As I said, this should be a very rare occurrence. Unfortunately, some situations do arise where a patient's actions or behaviors may create either a safety issue or be disruptive to the operation of the dialysis clinic. There are specific steps required under the Medicare conditions for coverage that a facility must follow in this situation. The medical director is responsible for ensuring that the facility adheres to these following steps. 1. The patient must have a comprehensive assessment by all members of their health care team. That would include the doctor, nurse, social worker, and dietitian. This is to determine what factors may be contributing to the conflict or problems that are occurring. This must be documented in the patient's medical record, along with what the problems are and the ongoing efforts of the health care team to help the patient resolve the problems. If the problems cannot be resolved and the patient's behavior is so extreme that it is disruptive and abusive to the point that it affects the delivery of patient care to other patients, or if the behaviors affect the ability of the facility to operate effectively, the facility may decide that discharge is the appropriate thing to do. In this case, the facility must provide the patient and the local ESRD network a 30-day notice of the planned discharge. This should only happen when the facility has tried pretty much everything and there are still serious problems occurring. There must be a written order signed by both the medical director and the patient's attending physician. This would be the nephrologist that provides their medical care. Both of these, the physician and medical director, must sign the order for the patient's discharge or transfer in order to show that both are in agreement with the planned discharge from the facility. The facility is responsible for contacting other dialysis facilities and making attempts to place the patient so they can continue to receive care. And the facility must also notify the state survey agency of the involuntary discharge or transfer. Now, in the case of a severe threat to the health and safety of others, the facility may have to use an abbreviated involuntary discharge procedure. This could occur if a patient were to come in with a weapon or is making serious and believable threats to do harm to someone. In a situation like this, there's probably no time for the facility staff to follow each step of the procedure, as they may have to obtain immediate assistance by calling 911 for immediate protective action. Now, let me give you a few examples of situations where an involuntary discharge is or is not appropriate. The types of things a patient might do that would not be reasons for involuntary discharge include things like skipping treatments, signing off treatments early or not getting the full prescribed treatment, having large weight gains between treatments, not taking medications as prescribed, not following diet like eating foods high in potassium or high in phosphate, or getting angry when someone makes a mistake. Now, you might wonder why the facility even cares about some of these things. After all, it's your life, and you should be able to do what you want, right? Well, aside from the fact that the clinic probably wants to make sure all patients are getting the best care they can, clinics are also judged by the surveyors and other outside agencies based on the clinical outcomes they have at their clinic. Things like how well the clinic dialyzes patients, this may be known as the adequacy of dialysis, or how well a clinic manages their patients' anemia. This information is posted on the CMS Dialysis Compare website so everyone can see it. As a matter of fact, in the next few years, this type of quality information will also have an impact on how much facilities get paid. So dialysis facilities are paying even more attention these days to how well their patients are doing. But none of these should be a reason for a clinic to discharge a patient. The clinic should work extra hard with these patients to educate them about why it is important to follow diet and fluid restrictions, why it's important to get their full dialysis treatments, because they want the patients to be as healthy as possible and live a long, full life. Now, for some examples of reasons a clinic might use the involuntary discharge process. Now, these examples may be rather extreme and even somewhat disturbing. I don't mean to offend anyone, but just want to use these to illustrate my point about situations that may justify an involuntary discharge. Now, this can include, as mentioned earlier, somebody bringing a weapon to the clinic and threatening to do harm. Acts of violence against a staff member or another patient, like hitting or kicking someone, inappropriate touching of staff members, and repeated ongoing loud and vulgar outbursts. In the last two examples of the inappropriate touching or repeated outbursts, you would expect the clinic to have made strong efforts to work with the patients doing these things, to have the patients stop the offending behavior, and to give patients explanations of the impact of those behaviors. For example, with the touching, this could be considered sexual harassment, and there are federal laws that the clinic must follow to prevent this from happening to their employees. With the loud, angry patient, if this happens once or twice and the patient stops this after being asked to do so, that's not a reason for discharge. But if a patient is continuously yelling and shouting obscenities every time they come to the clinic, well, this makes everyone upset, other patients and staff, and could even cause safety problems, like causing a nurse to be startled and jump just as they were inserting fistula needles into another patient, which could lead to a complication of that patient's vascular access. Not good. Thankfully, the situations I mentioned do not happen very often, but if they do, patients and staff can be assured that their clinic will try to do the right thing to maintain a safe and professional environment. This concludes my part of this conversation, and I thank you for the chance to talk to you all about these important topics.
Katrina, thanks so much. You were really able to help us understand these very complicated issues and the importance of patient satisfaction in the dialysis unit according to the new regulations. Let's now welcome our final speaker, Erin Herold. Erin is a licensed independent clinical social worker and graduate of the University of Washington's Master in Social Work program. She is the patient services coordinator at the Northwest Renal Network, and that's the End-Stage Renal Disease Network 16, which is located in Seattle, Washington. Erin has worked in the kidney disease field since 1999 and has been a member of the Executive Committee of the National Kidney Foundation's Council of Nephrology Social Workers since 2005. Welcome, Erin, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Sheila. I first of all would like to thank the National Kidney Foundation for hosting this call. I'd also like to acknowledge Beth for reviewing the regulatory rights of dialysis patients, and Katrina for reviewing how facilities should respond to patient concerns, and most importantly, Mary Beth, for adding the critical patient perspective in this conversation. In my part of this conversation, I would like to mention some thoughts about why people may be reluctant to bring up concerns, the option of contacting a renal network regarding your concerns, and the role of the state survey office in dealing with concerns. As you know, people with kidney disease have to cope with receiving care from many different professionals, including doctors, nurses, technicians, social workers, dietitians. They also have to deal with many different organizations, such as hospitals, dialysis centers, transplant programs, doctor's offices, transportation companies, and many, many others. It may become very frustrating and exhausting to deal with these various people and organizations. A patient may already be exhausted from the physical problems that come with a chronic illness and the normal demands of life. As a patient with a chronic condition, you often have a very different type of experience than a patient with coping with a short-term illness. For instance, if you are an in-center dialysis patient, you may see the staff at your dialysis center 3 times or more a week. As a result, you get to know your care team very well. These relationships can be supportive and make undergoing treatment just a little easier. No matter how much you like your care team or how satisfied you are with your care at this time, you will most likely have a concern about some aspect of your care at some point. Treatment for kidney disease requires you to interact closely with a care team made up of individuals. These individuals are human and may not do everything perfectly. It may be very uncomfortable for you or other patients to express these concerns. I think that it is important for us to discuss why patients may be uncomfortable to express these concerns. In my experience at the network and as a dialysis facility social worker, many patients fear being denied dialysis or a transplant if they bring up a concern. A patient may also be concerned about other negative consequences, such as losing a particular dialysis schedule. It is only natural to have this fear when you rely upon someone for life-sustaining treatment or your ability to get a transplant. Patients should know that the regulations for dialysis facilities do protect the rights of patients who bring up concerns, and that the various organizations that handle complaints also try to protect the rights of patients to raise concerns. Some patients may fear being seen as ungrateful. You may find yourself thinking that after all that the staff has done for you, how can you complain? Some patients lack confidence in their own knowledge of their kidney disease and treatment, and therefore think perhaps they may be wrong or do not understand something. Some patients just do not feel comfortable with confrontation. You may not want to be labeled as a, quote, complainer, or you may be concerned about offending somebody. Perhaps you feel uncomfortable raising a concern because of your family or cultural customs. For instance, you may have been taught not to question someone in authority. Maybe you have not had success in the past raising a concern. Perhaps you've tried and nothing has changed. It could be you do not have the time or the energy to deal with it because of physical or emotional fatigue. Patients sometimes have said to me, quote, I really do not have the energy to deal with this. I just want to come in and do my dialysis and go home. You may think to yourself, what does it matter? Whatever the reason, patients that do not raise concerns may not receive the care they need and deserve. Also, it may allow a problem to continue or worsen and does not give the facility's administration a chance to deal with a serious issue. So what do you do? One of the options is contacting one of the renal networks. The federal government created the renal network in 1977 when it approved Medicare funding for dialysis services. There are 18 renal networks across the United States. Each network is responsible for a specific state or region. Some of the renal networks are small independent organizations, and others are part of larger corporations. All the networks are contracted with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, a federal agency, to provide services to the renal community, including facilities and patients alike. These services include working with treatment providers to improve quality of care, providing educational and community resource information, collecting data for the government, and assisting patients with concerns and complaints, which is what we will discuss today. One of the most important responsibilities of a network is to respond to the concerns of patients at Medicare-certified facilities, which includes dialysis and transplant centers. When a patient decides to contact the network, they get to decide what type and the amount of help they want. They may request just to have a private talk with the network staff who are familiar with kidney treatment and failure, kidney treatment and kidney disease. For example, perhaps the patient wants to just check with someone else what they are being told by the dialysis staff or to discuss what they are seeing at the dialysis center. This is an opportunity for the patient to collect more information and to decide whether they have a good reason to be concerned. A patient may also use this opportunity to get ideas on how to approach the issue with staff. Perhaps the patient just wants the network to talk to them and the facility and try to resolve the issue. Sometimes patients are not comfortable bringing up concerns or already have tried and were unsuccessful. A patient can request to have the network get involved in the discussion. The network will work with the facility and the patient to find a solution to the problem. The network staff will often ask if you've already raised your concern or used the facility's grievance procedure. For those patients who are comfortable and wish to do so, you may be encouraged to use your facility's grievance procedure, as Katrina described earlier. You can also have the option of file a formal grievance. Patients can decide to file a formal grievance with the network. A formal grievance is very similar to the actions the network would have taken in the last example, but it's just a bit more formal in nature. It involves specific timelines and using certain formal procedures. The network may also offer to refer you to others. In some cases, the network will recommend that you contact another agency or make a referral to that agency for you. For instance, the network does not handle concerns regarding physicians or hospital care and will refer you to the appropriate organization. Once again, just to review the options available to patients, patients may request just to have a private talk with the network staff, request the network talk with them in their facility to resolve the problem, may file a formal grievance, or may receive a referral. I would also like to mention that anyone who contacts the network may choose not to reveal their identity, or may request that the network does not reveal their identity. In those cases, the network will attempt to do what it can to address the concerns, but it may have limited options. It is also important to know that the network may have to take action if someone reports a care issue that could be placing other patients at significant risk. But even in those cases, confidentiality will be respected. Each network has a toll-free number, and each facility is required to provide patients and post the contact information for the appropriate network. You can also get this information by going to the website for the ESRD National Coordinating Center at www.esrdncc.org. Once again, that number is at web address is www.esrdncc.org. Or you can call the National Coordinating Center at 516-209-5365, and they will identify which network you belong to. I also want to talk about the role of the State Survey Office. In addition to contacting the network, patients have the option of contacting their State Survey Office. State surveyors, as Beth mentioned earlier, are responsible for inspecting Medicare-certified dialysis facilities. In each state, either a State Survey Office or another agency is responsible for Medicare-certified transport programs as well. The state surveyors inspect the dialysis facilities to ensure that they are following the federal regulations, such as the rights that Beth mentioned earlier. In some states, the surveyors also enforce state-specific regulations, such as staffing ratios, quarterly charting requirements, or other types of regulations. If someone contacts the state survey office, the surveyors will attempt to investigate the person's complaint. The State Survey Office and the Reno Network often collaborate on issues of concern. Therefore, either one of these agencies may recommend that you contact the other one or work together on a concern. Just as in the case of the network, each facility is required to provide you with the contact information for your State Survey Office. I would like to finish up by emphasizing the following. The staff at the networks know that it takes strength and courage to bring up concerns. You can call the network to just discuss your concerns, even if you have not decided what to do about them. The network does not punish facilities, but instead is focused on working with the facility to address your concerns and on improving the quality of care for all patients. Well, I'll return the call to you, Sheila.
Thanks very much, Aaron. I feel that we're fortunate today to have heard from such qualified experts about these topics and the new regulations. And, you know, what's impressive to me is how important it is that dialysis facilities take patients' concerns, complaints, and grievances seriously according to these new rules. Why don't we take the remaining time to open this session up to questions and answers? Operator, we're now ready to begin our question and answer session.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. You will be prompted to record your first and last name so that you may be announced. To withdraw your question, you will press star 2. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. One moment, please, for our first question. And it looks like our first question comes from Diana. Your line is open.
Hi, I just had a question about the options that the dialysis centers have to let the patients know about. If, for example, does it all have to be within the corporation? Say, for example, we have a corporation that is a big one, and they have different options, but say they don't offer it at that particular unit, and say they don't offer it at any of the units around them, do they have to disclose information about another corporation giving extra options?
Diana, thank you for your question. That's an excellent question. Who on our panel would like to respond?
Just Beth, I'll take it. The dialysis clinic is responsible for educating patients about all their options for treatment, so that includes the options of transplant, both living related or living donor transplants and deceased donor transplants, all forms of home dialysis, of which there are 5 different types of home dialysis, the CAPD, the cycler, the conventional home hemodialysis, the daily home hemodialysis, and the nocturnal home hemodialysis, and also let people know that there is an option for nocturnal in-center dialysis.
Right, and that's what I do, is I do in-center nocturnal. But my concern was, say, for example, that it was, you know, the corporation is offering it, but there is that option available out there. And say, for example, another place does not offer it, but they would have to provide another company's name? Is that correct?
Well, they're supposed to provide resource information to help patients find it. I don't know, you know, if Aaron wants to answer that from the network perspective, but my suggestion to any dialysis clinic to meet this requirement would be to, at minimum, let the patients know how to find that information, either through websites or to make a list of the facilities that offer the different treatments in the area.
Okay. I just didn't know if it was just limited to
Not limited to their corporation.
Okay.
I'm sure that a dialysis corporation would want to, you know, keep a patient if they can and if they have the treatment available in a reasonable geographic area, you know, hopefully that would work out. If they don't, the patient could go outside that area and outside that clinic.
Okay. Thank you.
Does anybody else have anything to add to Beth's response from the panel?
No, I think she covered it.
Okay, thank you. We'll take our next question, please.
Our next question will come from Paul. Your line's open, sir.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment that, you know, I'm a volunteer with the National Kidney Foundation as well as a PAC representative at CDC here in Buffalo. And I just wanted to ask if they can repeat that number one more time in a website for the surveys.
For the Reno Network or for...
For the Reno Network, correct.
Yes, that website is www.esrdncc.org.
Okay.
And the phone number is, unfortunately, it's not a 1-800 number. It's 516-209-5365.
Thank you, because I just wanted to say as a PAC rep, the information would be very wonderful. So far, we haven't had problems at the dialysis center I'm going to right now. As a PAC rep, you know, I do hear some things that, you know, some patients like to complain, but sometimes they're afraid to because of either, you know, they don't want to get the nurse into trouble or the tech into trouble or other patients. And I just wanted to say that it was a very, very interesting, you know, group session today that they were talking about things like that that happen at dialysis centers.
Paul, thank you very much for your question and your comment.
You're welcome.
If I could add to what Aaron has said and the resource information he provided, if you go to the National Kidney Foundation's website, the patient section, which would be www.nkfkidneypatients.org,
okay,
you can find resources there and a direct link also to the Network Coordinating Center website, the list of networks.
Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Paul.
Hey, Sheila, can I add something to the folks on the call that may want to locate facilities that are doing different types of treatment?
Yes.
The Medicare website has dialysis facility compare on its website, and that's www.medicare.gov/dialysis. So you can look there. You can search within a certain geographic area. You can search by name of the facility. You can search by your city, by your state. There are a whole bunch of ways you can search to find clinics. I wish that they had it so that you could search by treatment option, but
right
now they don't have that.
Right.
The other website where there's information about home dialysis options is Home Dialysis Central, which is www.homedialysis.org. And that website has a variety of clinics listed there. One thing that is a limiter on either one of these websites is that the facilities have to keep the website updated when they add or they stop offering a certain treatment. So if you're going to a clinic that offers a home therapy,
mm-hmm,
and you look at that website and you don't see that it's listed on either one of them, be sure to let your clinic know that it needs to alert either one of those websites or both about what treatments mm-hmm they offer.
Okay. Thank you, Beth.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And I just want to say, is it Katrina?
Yes.
Thank you so much for your input on the other topic, too, that you mentioned about, you know, how patients, you know, sometimes act in dialysis centers. Because I know we have one right now that kind of acts a little, you know, somewhat rude at times. And, you know, we have brought that up at some of our PAC rep meetings and, you know, some other issues on the topics that you were talking about as well. And I just wanted to say thank you for, you know, putting some insight on that as well.
Well, I'd like to add to that, too, being a social worker, and I know Aaron is, too.
Mm-hmm.
When patients act out or act rude or sometimes act angry,
mm-hmm,
sometimes it's because they're feeling out of control or they're feeling depressed, and that's just the way that it's reflected. So the social worker may be able to help address those concerns. So hopefully the social worker is involved with that patient.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, that's such a good example of
I think the team approach to care of dialysis patients, because first the patient care tech, the social worker, all working together to address those concerns. And, you know, I think a lot of patients I've seen that may act out are really scared underneath.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, definitely, definitely, definitely. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. This is a really interesting discussion.
Mm-hmm. Sheila, I would also just, this is Aaron, I'd also like to mention, I can't say, can't overemphasize the comment that patients, you know, are reluctant to contact the network or other agencies because they're concerned about getting the facilities in trouble or the staff. And I think that patients, you know, I can't emphasize, they can call the network even before they've made a decision to actually do a complaint or grievance and just discuss their concerns. So they don't have to be at the point where they really have a concern or complaint. They can just contact one of the renal networks and discuss their concerns, and we'll help them think that process through.
That's very helpful, Aaron. I'm sure that it helps to have someone to just brainstorm with when you are experiencing a problem, for example, in your dialysis center. And it's also good to know that the new regulations support that and support patients who do discuss their concerns.
Exactly.
Let's take our next question now, please.
Our next question comes from Tawana. Your line is open.
Hi. I'm a new social worker new to dialysis. My question is about involuntary discharges. If you have patients who are just not showing up for treatment, how would you recommend handling that, you know, according to the new regs?
Shall I take that one?
Sure.
Tawana, welcome to the world of dialysis. I hope your experience is turning out to be a good one. This can be a very challenging topic. With the new Medicare conditions for coverage, a patient who's not showing up would be considered an unstable patient, and each discipline should come together and do a comprehensive assessment of what's going on with that patient. I don't know if your particular organization has implemented their process for doing the interdisciplinary team assessment, but this sounds like a candidate for it. So trying to find out why isn't the patient showing up and what are the underlying root causes and can you do something about it? You need to really take that to its fullest extent so that you can identify the patient's problems and then hopefully create an appropriate plan of care for that patient. Is there anything more you can tell me about this particular patient? It's just somebody who's not showing up?
There's actually two.
Well, skipping treatments is not a reason for discharge.
Right.
And it's a reason to get closer to them to find out what the problem is.
Right. And I understand what you mean about skipping treatments, but I mean, in these cases, they're just not coming for long periods of time. And so, you know, we've made efforts to get them in. One person is in a nursing home, and so we've been going to see that patient, you know, because we can find them, but the other person we really can't find, honestly.
Well, as long as you're documenting your efforts, in that case, you may want to consider sending out the sheriff or police for a welfare check. If you can't find them, there's not a whole lot you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And Aaron, correct me, but if somebody doesn't receive care at a facility for more than 30 days, I don't think they're supposed to be continued on the census at the network, are they?
It depends upon the circumstances as to whether you know the reason they're not there or not. So it depends, and also varies between networks a little bit.
On the nursing home patient, I'd be pretty aggressive on that one because the nursing home is responsible for transporting that patient in for dialysis treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And your facility should have a written agreement with that nursing home or skilled nursing facility as to how they are going to collaborate to care for the dialysis patients.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps you need to reach out or even get some of the clinical staff to help reach out and make sure that nursing home facility staff understands their responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been working closely with them.
One thing that, you know, might be going on with the nursing home patient anyway, and I don't know about the other one, is that the patient may really not want to do dialysis at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the question would be whether that patient is trying to say, you know, I'm just ready to let natural death occur as opposed to, you know, doing dialysis. And it may be that family or somebody else is, you know, trying to encourage the patient to come to dialysis, but maybe isn't as involved as, you know, driving the patient there. So that would be another issue to talk with the patient about if the patient's competent, you know, find out whether or not the patient is wanting to do dialysis, what's the reason why they're not coming in, could it be that they're uncomfortable while they're on dialysis, if they're used to lying in a bed and they have to sit in a dialysis chair, which may not be particularly comfortable, that could be a reason why the patient isn't coming. There are just all kinds of reasons
why
a patient might
not
show up.
Yeah.
I would like to add, I think the facilities can be caught in a situation where they're trying to address the issue, but what they're actually doing may be making it worse. If, you know, if a patient is only coming once every week or is missing a lot of treatment, then when they do come in, they're faced with a bunch of questions from the staff and you know, statements, don't you know what you're doing to your body? That's not a very supportive approach, and it just reinforces the patient's desire not to come to treatment. And so I think taking a supportive approach and working from where the patient is, if the patient only wants to come twice a week and for a period of time, really acknowledging that, encouraging them to come three times a week, but it is their choice in a lot of these situations, and not getting into a struggle with them and only adding negative reinforcements that when they do show up, they have all these negative experiences.
I completely agree.
Also, if they're only coming once a week and they're having to remove a whole lot of fluid, they're probably feeling pretty lousy when they leave, which could make them not want to come back.
Okay.
Juana, I hope that information has been helpful, and I hope that you're able to walk away from this call with feeling more informed about how you might move forward with this situation.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for joining the call today. We appreciate hearing from you.
Okay, thank you for your suggestion.
You're welcome. Well, we'd like to take another question now, please.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Looks like our next question comes from Cleo. Your line's open.
Hello. Thank you, everybody, for wonderful, informative presentations. My question is regarding, if I understood what Aaron said correctly, that if there is a problem with the nephrologist in the dialysis unit, that the network and these guidelines, or the rules and regulations, do not apply or affect that person, there's another way to deal with that. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. You really should contact the network, your individual network, to kind of walk through that, because it does vary somewhat. Nephrologists are expected, the medical director of the dialysis facility is expected to ensure that nephrologists are following the policies and procedures of the dialysis facility, and the networks do have some and the end state surveyors do have some oversight of the role of medical directors. So it's not an outright that there is no authority. So you do need to contact your network to discuss its concerns more clearly and directly with them. But in general, if they don't have authority, they'll usually refer you to the medical association of that state or to the quality improvement organization, which is the federal contractor that has authority over physicians that receive Medicare payments. So those are the two organizations that they would refer you on to. But definitely contact your network to make sure that they aren't having any authority in this situation.
Aaron, I'm sorry, could you repeat medical association for the state? What was the other one?
A quality improvement organization, what's called a QIO.
Okay.
This is Beth. Can I ask a question, Cleo, about can you not giving the name of the doctor or anything like that? What kind of issue is it related to the doctor?
Well, I have seen things over the years. I happen to be a registered nurse. And because Aaron brought that up, and we were talking about all the other disciplines, and they are covered under there, I thought it could be helpful to clarify about the physician.
Okay.
So
well,
I'll give you an example.
Okay.
I have seen more than once a nephrologist talking to a person on dialysis, a person perhaps who has drank more than he or she wanted them to, or ate more of this or that, and screaming at them that their numbers are no good and they're making them look bad, and if they don't change their numbers, that they're going to be off their service.
Well, that's definitely an issue related to dignity and respect.
Right,
the patient's
right.
not being treated in a way that is appropriate, and the medical director and the facility manager could deal with that situation, and the state surveyor could cite the clinic governing body for that.
And it has involved the medical director saying this as well.
And without knowing the details, I think Beth is correct. Because it's happening in the facility, there may be something that the network or the state survey agency could do about it. If this was happening, in the doctor's office, then that would be a different situation.
Right.
Right. No, this was, it has occurred in the dialysis unit. Like I say, I've heard it more than once in different dialysis units, and I feel it's terribly inappropriate behavior.
Well, and if I can add my two cents worth, too, I don't think a nephrologist can truly discharge a patient from their service because they don't have the numbers that the nephrologist or the facility is expecting. That might be something, if it really continues, that the State Medical Association could get involved in, because if the nephrologist actually did discharge the patient, that could be abandonment.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also important to say that the a medical relationship between the patient and the nephrologist is a separate relationship than the patient and the facility. Those are two separate legal relationships, even though a lot of facilities, it gets a little confused if there's only one or two nephrologists that have all the patients at that facility. They are separate relationships.
And, you know, this is Sheila. I think what I'm hearing is how challenging these situations might be for patients and how difficult and emotionally difficult it might be for patients to address these concerns. So I urge patients, and I think we all do, to get support if you do have concerns, any of these types of concerns, and you can get support through a professional person in your dialysis unit who you might have a special and supportive relationship with, or someone at the network such as Aaron has suggested. So don't feel that you have to handle these types of situations alone.
Well, and if I could offer one other suggestion to Cleo, this sounds like an opportunity for the nephrologist and or medical director to be educated about their responsibilities under these new Medicare conditions for coverage, and that quite frankly the kind of behavior that you're describing I think would be a lot more problematic than a patient not achieving the numbers that a surveyor may be looking at in a QAPI program.
Yes.
Well, and there's also the option that patients who are treated that way always have the option to go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Go to a different doctor, go to a different clinic. You know, and I've personally worked in dialysis clinics, and I've personally seen some of the things that you describe, and I've also seen patients that left those doctors. So if they want to maintain their practice to some extent, you've got to treat people respectfully.
Right. And of course, it's a very difficult, awkward situation for everybody.
Including the people that watch it that are on the staff.
Absolutely. It's like, watching a view. Yeah.
Well, Cleo, thank you very much for your question. We appreciate hearing from you. I think we have time for maybe one more question. Do we have another question?
Our next question comes from Michael. Your line's open.
Hi,
Michael. Hi, Sheila. It's a statement and then a question. One is, I want to thank you and NKF for the wonderful Coffee House series. It's really been a fantastic trip. And I was wondering whether it might make sense for people who benefited from this might want to communicate with you the impact that it's had on them.
Thank you for saying that, Mike. That's a great idea. And we would appreciate hearing from you. If you do have any comments about how these calls have helped you, if you found that you've been empowered to talk with the professionals in your dialysis units about concerns you have had and if you've seen any changes as a result of your discussions. We would appreciate very much hearing back from you as to what types of discussions you've had and what the impact has been. Thank you, Mike, for sharing that suggestion.
I sent you an email this morning on the impact it's had on me.
Yes. Do you want to? Well, I can share briefly what Mike had shared with us is that he had a concern about hand washing practices that he observed on the part of the professionals in his dialysis unit, and as a result of his discussions and concerns and communication about this problem, his dialysis unit has undertaken improved improved hand washing practices, and hand washing was the subject of their weekly in-service training. So Mike shared this with us, and we can see from his experience that talking with your dialysis unit about your concerns can have a major impact.
But may I add that you have to be polite, low-key, and persistent, and that paid off.
Great. Thank you, Mike.
And thank you, NKF, and thank you, Sheila.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, I think we'll have to wrap up today's call. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for participating today. I would like to thank our expert panel members for sharing their expertise to help us become empowered. And I'd like to invite everyone to visit our website, www.kidney.org/coffeehouse. You can hear previous Coffeehouse Conversation calls on the website. You can link to resources, publications, and booklets about these calls. And also, we'd like you to go there to fill out a survey about today's calls, today's call, and previous calls that you may have heard. Our next call is scheduled for March 4th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And that call is in celebration of March Kidney Month. The topic of the call is the power of people like us, about advocacy and how to make your voice heard on important kidney disease issues. Once again, thank you for joining us today, and we hope you will join us next time.
And this will conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect.